between Moses and Roosevelt, all that changed. When the Jones Beach opening ceremonies were held, Roosevelt was there, having been wheeled up on the boardwalk on a ramp Moses had thought to have constructed. When it came time, during the gubernatorial election year summer of 1930, to mortar into place the cornerstone for the West Bathhouse, it was Roosevelt who was invited to wield the trowel and to tell 75,000 cheering onlookers that the building, which he said would cost $600,000, would help ensure health and happiness for generations of New Yorkers. Moses also invited the governor to tour all the Long Island parks. The tour was staged on a Sunday, and the Monday papers were full of pictures of the governor smiling out over the picnickers at Valley Stream and Hempstead Lake. When he arrived at Hexer State Park, where bathers had been complaining about overcrowding in the bathhouse, Moses even let him be the one to announce, to cheers and applause, that ground would be broken for a new one by the end of the summer. It was the kind of publicity that money can't buy. Roosevelt was so pleased that, in his speeches, he called Moses Bob. In 1931, Moses invited Roosevelt to lay the cornerstone for the monument marking the start of the Northern State Parkway, and afterward, Moses' limousine led the governors to Jones Beach for lunch in the balcony restaurant in the new bathhouse, the construction of which had officially begun the year before. The attendance at Jones Beach that day was 100,000, and as word spread that Roosevelt was present, a great sea of faces pressed close to the restaurant. When the governor, moved, made his way to a balcony over the bathhouse swimming pool for an impromptu talk, the bathers in the pool shouted happily up at him and cheered. Jones Beach had been an expensive development, the governor shouted back to them, but it was the best money the state ever spent. If he recalled in that moment of euphoria that the bathhouse on whose balcony he was standing had cost $1 million instead of the $600,000 he had been told it would a year earlier, he did not mention the discrepancy. Al Smith was present at every dedication, too. As long as Smith lived, Moses would never hold a cornerstone laying, a ribbon cutting, or any public ceremony of any type anywhere in the state without inviting the governor and offering him a prominent spot on the program. But Roosevelt couldn't even bridle at this. There was, in regard to the Long Island Park system, more than enough credit to go around. Moses was fond of repeating at this time a quote often used in Albany. You can get an awful lot of good done in the world if you're willing to let someone else take the credit for it. Certainly, Moses was willing at least to share the credit for the work he had done with the man he needed if he was to get more done. And if accomplishment and willingness to share the credit for that accomplishment was part of the explanation for the increase in Moses' power under a governor who had no inclination to increase it, the accomplishment helped explain this contradiction in other ways, too. One way is that no governor could sit in the executive chamber long without discovering just how hard, how incredibly hard, it was, even for a governor, to get things, big things, done. No governor, having made this discovery, could look at what Robert Moses had gotten done without being impressed, without feeling admiration for his ability, without a recognition of his extraordinary capacity as a public servant. And the proof of this is that through some of the letters and memos written to Moses by Roosevelt during the last 2 years of his 4-year gubernatorial regime, through letters and memos interspersed with others in which irritation and even rage are only thinly glossed over, for Roosevelt's personal animosity toward Moses never lessened, there runs a tone that is unmistakably respect. Another way is that accomplishment proves the potential for more accomplishment. The man who gets things done once can get things done again, and the potential for accomplishment has very strong political connotations indeed. For political, if not personal reasons, Roosevelt wanted, needed, to get things done. Furthermore, he was trapped, as all politicians in elected offices are trapped, by the inexorable equation of democracy and public works. Elections come every 2 years, or four, and the official who wants re-election needs a record of accomplishment on which to run. Such a record, in the America of the first half of the 20th century, and perhaps in the America of the second half of the 20th century too, from a political standpoint, should be most ideally a record of public works. And it has to be a record of public works completed, roads opened, bridges built, housing project apartments occupied, bathhouses crowded with bathers, parks in which the happy shouts of children fill the ear and not just the imagination. It is no good still to be laying cornerstones on election day. By then, a public official in executive office must have ribbons he can cut, monuments to which he can point with pride. This is a requirement established by democracy as it has evolved in America. Yet the realities of the democratic process in America make it almost impossible to get a road, a bridge, a housing project, a bathhouse, or a park approved and built in 2 years, or four. The governor who finds a man who can inject into the democracy public works equation a factor of personality so heavy as to unbalance it and get public works built during the span of a single term of office has little choice, if he is ambitious for political success, but to heap on that man more and more responsibilities, even though the giving of responsibilities carries with it the grant of more power. In this context, moreover, Moses' arrogance toward opposition was an asset rather than a liability to an elected official. Almost all public works arouse some opposition. Roads require land, and some of the citizens from whom the land must be taken do not want it taken. And if the opposition is directed at an elected official, it can be translated into votes against him the next time his name appears on a ballot. But by leaping to deal with opposition himself, and by dealing with it in a way that antagonized the opposition, Moses made himself a lightning rod, drawing the anger at the project onto himself and leaving the elected official unscathed. The official, therefore, could bask in the credit, at least some of the credit, from the majority of voters, who until the 1960s worshipped public works projects in and for themselves, while escaping the wrath of the minority who opposed it. In 1930, the president of the Valley Stream Chamber of Commerce asked Roosevelt to inspect the worst grade crossing problem on Long Island, a spot in the center of the village. Roosevelt agreed, and when his limousine was surrounded by a large crowd of local businessmen, and one handed him a petition to Public Service Commission Chairman Milo Maltby demanding immediate action, Roosevelt, in a grandstand gesture, signed the petition himself. The gesture showed Roosevelt's gift for public relations, but having made it, the governor now had to provide some action. Difficult to do because the engineering problems involved were incredibly complex, and the railroad had threatened to tie the whole matter up in court for years if the state attempted to force a solution on it. Having played the ham, Roosevelt needed someone to pull his eggs out of the fire. He selected Moses, who made it very clear that he was doing the job only as a favor. Nonetheless, his first glance at the problem produced a solution. Maltby turned it down. But when Moses wrote Roosevelt, "Under the circumstances, I must ask to be relieved of any further responsibility," the governor hastily interceded with Maltby, and Moses' solution was adopted, immediately eased the traffic situation, and brought praise to Roosevelt for solving the problem. No governor would interfere with an official who could thus spectacularly achieve on his behalf. He wouldn't interfere even when the official actually tried to strangle a colleague. The incident occurred in Moses' office in the State Parks Council suite. Moses was presiding over a meeting of the council's finance committee when Raymond H. Torrey walked into the room. Torrey, a pudgy little man, a bird watcher, hiker, and lover of the deep woods who spent weekends building lean-tos on Adirondack trails so that other hikers would have shelter, had long been a symbol of frustration to Moses. His very presence in the Parks Council offices was a reminder to Moses that his control of that body, while substantial, was not total. Torrey had long been secretary of the American Scenic and Historic Preservation Society, whose trustees had long been ashamed that they could not afford to pay him an adequate salary, and in the days of the Taylor estate fight, when Moses had so desperately needed the help of the Society's park patriots, he had sought to cultivate them by naming Torrey secretary of the Parks Council at a salary of $6,000 per year. After the fight, when Moses, not needing them anymore, was scourging the patriots out of their parks and trying to wrest Letchworth Park from the Society's control, he had reduced Torrey's salary as much as civil service laws allowed, and made his title a meaningless one by giving his responsibilities to his assistant, Henry Lutz. But civil service laws prevented Moses from firing Torrey, and he was a constant reminder that the Society still had some say in Letchworth's administration. Torrey had proven a thorn in Moses' side in other ways, too. He saw the fight over the Northern State Parkway route through the eyes of the dedicated conservationist, familiar, more familiar perhaps than any other man, with the beauties of the North Shore's glacial moraine. He didn't want a highway, no matter how beautifully landscaped, to run along it. When a newspaper article appearing supported this view, Torrey reprinted it in the Society's monthly newsletter. On September 12, 1929, Moses learned that Torrey had provided information about Parks Council proceedings on the Parkway route to Grenville Clark, the attorney for the North Shore Barons, from whom Moses had been attempting to hide his maneuvering. He left word that Torrey should report to his office as soon as he came in. Torrey did so, walking in on the Finance Committee meeting. Cursing, his face alternately paling and purpling with rage, Moses began to heap abuse on Torrey. Torrey said that the information he had given Clark was information to which any member of the public was entitled. Moses then launched into a tirade about the reprinting of the newspaper article in the Society newsletter. Torrey said that Moses had no right to tell him what he could print. "God damn you!" Moses shouted. "What do you mean by doing something like that?" Torrey was mild-mannered, almost invariably soft-spoken, and among his closest friends were Jewish social workers from the Lower East Side settlement houses. "I've endured many verbal assaults from Mr. Moses and said little because he is bigger than I am and because we, the Society, have been almost alone in the council in our defense against his aggressions," Torrey was to write. "But his manner and curses irritated me on this occasion beyond further restraint, and I retorted, 'You big, noisy kike, you can't talk to me like that.'" Lunging from his chair, Moses seized Torrey's throat and began choking him. So violent was his rage that when Finance Committee member Jay Downer tried to pull Moses off, he was at first unable to do so and had to exert all his strength to pry loose first one of Moses' hands and then the other. As he freed Torrey, Downer grabbed Moses around the waist to hold him and told the smaller man to get away. But as Torrey headed for the door, Moses broke free, picked up a heavy smoking stand and match holder, 3-foot steel base and all, and shouting, "You goddamn son of a bitch!" hurled it at him. Only the fact that another committee member, DeHart Ames, grabbed Moses' arm as he was letting go the heavy missile made it fall short. Recounting the incident in a letter to Roosevelt, Torrey said, "I was, of course, at fault for using kike," but added that Moses' conduct was only one example of his truculence and violence against anyone who opposes him. "Under Moses' control," Torrey wrote, "the council has lost its original character as an advisory body of eminent citizens working amicably together and has become a vehicle for securing advantages for Moses, for granting favors for his supporters, and for supporting his hostility to any who oppose him." He asked Roosevelt to limit Moses' powers. When the governor did not reply, Torrey gave his letter to the press. But Moses was not at all abashed. His only regret, he said, was that he had not been permitted to finish that crackpot. And Roosevelt, pressed for comment by reporters, would say only, "It is a matter for the State Council of Parks, and I do not figure in it." The only result of Moses' assault was that Torrey resigned, allowing Moses to appoint Henry Lutz to his place, and the trustees of the Americ Scenic and Historic Preservation Society, realizing that their conflict with Moses had reached an intolerable pass and that they could not win, in 1930 gave up the Society's control of Letchworth Park and its place on the Parks Council, thereby making Moses' control of that body absolute. Roosevelt wouldn't interfere, even when he found out that Moses was discouraging Negroes from using many of his state parks. Underlying Moses' strikingly strict policing for cleanliness in his parks was, Francis Perkins realized with shock, deep distaste for the public that was using them. "He didn't love the people," she was to say. "It used to shock me because he was doing all these things for the welfare of the people. He'd denounce the common people terribly. To him, they were lousy, dirty people, throwing bottles all over Jones Beach. I'll get them. I'll teach them. He loves the public, but not his people. The public is just the public. It's a great amorphous mass to him. It needs to be bathed. It needs to be aired. It needs recreation, but not for personal reasons, just to make it a better public." Now he began taking measures to limit use of his parks. He had restricted the use of state parks by poor and lower middle class families in the first place, by limiting access to the parks by rapid transit. He had vetoed the Long Island Railroad's proposed construction of a branch spur to Jones Beach for this reason. Now he began to limit access by buses. He instructed Shapiro to build the bridges across the new parkways low, too low for buses to pass. Bus trips, therefore, had to be made on local roads, making the trips discouragingly long and arduous. For Negroes, whom he considered inherently dirty, there were further measures. Buses needed permits to enter state parks. Buses chartered by Negro groups found it very difficult to obtain permits, particularly to Moses' beloved Jones Beach. Most were shunted to parks many miles further out on Long Island. And even in these parks, buses carrying Negro groups were shunted to the furthest reaches of the parking areas. And Negroes were discouraged from using white beach areas, the best beaches, by a system Shapiro calls flagging. The handful of Negro lifeguards, there were only a handful of Negro employees among the thousands employed by the Long Island State Park Commission, were all stationed at distant, least developed beaches. Moses was convinced that Negroes did not like cold water. The temperature at the pool at Jones Beach was deliberately icy to keep Negroes out. When Negro civic groups from the hot New York City slums began to complain about this treatment, Roosevelt ordered an investigation, and an aide confirmed that Bob Moses is seeking to discourage large Negro parties from picnicking at Jones Beach, attempting to divert them to some other of the state parks. Roosevelt gingerly raised the matter with Moses, who denied the charge violently, and the governor never raised the matter again. Roosevelt wouldn't interfere even when Moses, ostensibly to raise money for soaring park maintenance costs, further limited park use by the poor by instituting parking fees at all state parks, 50 cents at Jones Beach, 25 at the rest, in violation of the American tradition of free parks. There was a flood of letters to Roosevelt from Depression-impoverished citizens who said that they had to scrimp to get enough money for the gas to drive to the park, and that the extra quarter would be the straw that would sometimes make it impossible for them to afford the outing. Moses had announced that in some parks there will be free parking space for those unable to pay, somewhat remote from the center. This, protesters said, would only make poor families pay a toll in pride instead of coin. "Who would wish to be classed among those unable to pay?" one asked. "To come walking in from the remote parking fields would be to exhibit the badge of poverty." Roosevelt wrote Moses, "I was a good deal impressed by the complaint. I also think 50 cents is too high. Frankly, I think the people have a legitimate kick. Won't you seriously take up the question of reducing the Jones Park charge?" "No," Moses said. He wouldn't. And when Roosevelt pressed again, he brought out his resignation threat. Reducing the charge would force him to reduce Jones Beach maintenance standards, he said. The entire character of the place would be changed, and if it was, I do not care to be associated. Roosevelt may have felt that the people have a legitimate kick, but in the face of such a defense, the governor punted. Not only did he drop his own request for reconsideration, when the legislature passed a bill prohibiting fees in state parks, he vetoed it. Not only does a governor not interfere with an official like Robert Moses, he heaps on him more and more responsibilities. No matter what the job was, it seemed, if it was difficult, Roosevelt turned to the same man. During 1930, 1931, and 1932, Moses handled more than a dozen special assignments for Roosevelt and produced results on every one. And if increasing Moses' responsibilities meant increasing his power, giving him more money to work with, more engineers, architects, draftsmen, and police to work with, well, the governor simply had no choice but to increase that power. By 1932, with the governor, running for president, less able than ever to afford a public controversy in his own state with so popular a figure, if one of the two characters in the Moses-Roosevelt drama was dominant, it was not the governor, but his appointee. The hatred between Roosevelt and Moses flared up only occasionally during the 4 years that the former spent in the executive chamber in Albany. But that passion and the desire for revenge that it engendered was only banked, not extinguished, and it never stopped smoldering. It was to blaze up into the open later, when Roosevelt was president. But Roosevelt was not president yet, and he could not yet afford to indulge such a passion. In his dealings with Moses during his gubernatorial years, necessity was the mother of accommodation. The uniqueness of Moses' relationship to the governor, of whose administration he was at least nominally a member, was emphasized when Al Smith finally decided to run against him for the Democratic presidential nomination. Moses calmly informed Roosevelt that he would be taking a few weeks off to work for Roosevelt's opponent. The Happy Warrior's last campaign was born, and was to die, in unrelieved bitterness. Smith had plenty to be bitter about. Roosevelt's systematic and pointed disregard of his predecessor had continued. Smith could not reconcile himself to the fact that the younger man, of whom he had been so fond and to whom he had given the gubernatorial nomination, had turned on him. Friends who visited him in New York found that Roosevelt was becoming almost an obsession with him. "Do you know, by God, that he has never consulted me about a damn thing since he has been governor?" he said to one. "He has taken bad advice from sources not friendly to me. He has ignored me." And Roosevelt was not the only younger man who had treated Smith with ingratitude. The treatment he had received from Jimmy Walker had wounded him even more deeply. At the request of Walker's father, an old friend, he had taken Walker under his wing when the young legislator had first come to Albany, rooming with him, steering him up the legislative ladder, helping him time and again out of the scandals in which he was constantly becoming embroiled because of his drinking, his compulsive philandering, and his inability to pay attention to the job to which he had been elected. When Smith determined in 1925 to oust Hyland from the mayoralty, Walker had asked Smith to make him Hyland's successor. Smith had told Walker frankly that he felt too worried about his playboy antics to do so. Walker had tricked him into changing his mind. He disappeared completely from the night spots that were his usual haunts and began to be seen in more respectable establishments with his wife. When he told Smith he was on the wagon for good, Smith secured him the nomination. But what Smith didn't know was that Walker had been engaging in all of his old activities and had been doing so in a secluded penthouse rented for him by a friend who had reasons for his own for wanting Beau James to be mayor. Safely installed in City Hall, Walker had shipped his wife off to Miami for an extended vacation, returned to his public habits, and when Smith had left the governorship and lost power, Walker had begun ousting Smith's friends from key city posts to make way for his own men, called by one observer the worst element in Tammany Hall. Then Walker began taking over the hall. Smith could have stopped him, but, determined to stay out of politics, he disdained to do so. When he realized the depth of the corruption pervading city government, he tried to reassert his authority, but by then it was too late. Walker was even able to force out Smith's man, Judge George W. Olvaney, as Tammany leader, with Olvaney attempting to save face by resigning because of ill health. And then Walker publicly humiliated Smith. At the annual dinner of the Inner Circle, the press room regulars at City Hall, Walker paused during his speech, turned to Olvaney, and with a glance at Smith that no one in the room missed, said, "How's your health, George?" The reporters laughed, and Smith knew they were laughing at him as much as at Olvaney. And when Walker handpicked Olvaney's successor, he chose Smith's enemy, John F. Curry. There was no place left for Smith in the party he had loved and led. All through 1931, Smith refused to run for the presidency. One by one, the state's key Democrats, Farley and Flynn notable among them, came to him and said that Roosevelt was asking them to join his campaign, but that their first loyalty was to Smith. All he had to do was ask them to stick with him, and they would do so. And all through 1931, Smith told them that he would never be a candidate for the presidency, and that they were free to join Roosevelt, which they did. But in early 1932, Smith's bitterness spilled over. His intimates would long debate whether Smith entered the presidential race because he wanted the nomination himself or because he wanted to deny it to the man who had treated him so cavalierly. Probably both elements were mixed. Certainly, Smith was motivated by personal ambition. In 1932, he was, after all, only 58 years old, still vigorous and bored with the life of a businessman. He was motivated also by the fact that the Depression made election of the Democratic candidate, even a Catholic Democratic candidate, a virtual certainty, and he desperately wanted to prove that being a Catholic and an Irishman did not disqualify a man from the presidency. One visitor, listening to Smith recount how it had been the religious issue that had defeated him in 1928, said, "He felt so terribly hurt, so outraged by that, and the point that he was making was that having been defeated on that issue in a year in which he was bound to be defeated, everybody, including FDR, should have stood aside to let him have the nomination in a year in which he could have been elected. He was very much wrought up about it. He pounded his fists and his voice got loud. He shouted at times in that conversation." But no consideration was stronger than Smith's feeling toward Roosevelt in pushing him at the last moment into a race foredoomed by the fact that Roosevelt had a 4-year head start. Moses saw at once that the effort was hopeless. "The Smith movement never had a chance," he was to recall. "It started very late and really had no organization to speak of." He never let himself be deluded by those reminders of past glories which gave Bell Moskowitz, Henry Moskowitz, Judge Proskauer, Herbert Bayard Swope, and George McLaughlin flashes of hope. The rallying of Walker and Tammany to Smith's side after Roosevelt had authorized Samuel Seabury to investigate corruption in New York City. The defection to Smith's banner of big city organizations and the consequent raising of his delegate count to 201. The wild cheers of the tremendous throng that lined his route from the LaSalle Street station in Chicago to the Congress Hotel, where a Smith for President headquarters had been hastily established. But practical realities did not weigh with Moses where Al Smith was concerned. Moses was one of those who struggled to the end in convention maneuvering so bitter that Ed Flynn called it a fight to the death, who fought to hold together an alliance of dark horses that denied Roosevelt the nomination until the fourth ballot, who thought for a few brief hours that they actually had Roosevelt stopped and would be able to force the party to turn to Smith, and whose hopes were finally dashed when the ex-governor's old adversary, William Randolph Hearst, used his influence with California's William G. McAdoo and John Nance Garner, governor of Texas, to force the California and Texas delegations to switch to Roosevelt. Moses was one of the small group of friends who sat down with Smith in front of a radio in the Congress Hotel to listen to the last ballot, who watched the former governor haul himself wearily out of his chair as soon as McAdoo began the speech that signaled the California switch, and with a wave of his hand direct them to start packing so they could leave Chicago. He was one of those who sneaked out of a Congress Hotel by a side door with Smith at the moment that crowds were jamming the front entrance to greet the arriving Roosevelt, who listened to the ex-governor, cornered by reporters, refused to say he would support his party's choice, and who watched anxiously as Smith sat silent on the long train ride home, with his face marked by what one observer called a tired sadness. And if Moses accepted Smith's defeat with his mind, he never accepted it with his heart. A month after the convention, with Happy Days Are Here Again drowning out the strains of the sidewalks of New York forever in the Democratic Party's consciousness, Smith's campaign staff held its first and only reunion, complete with a menu featuring Nuts McAdoo, Celery Farley, and Branchless Olives, Roosevelt, in the Empire State Club in the Empire State Building. And Moses' contribution to the occasion reflected his bitterness. It was a quotation from Shakespeare that he selected for an epigraph on the menu's cover. "Politics is a thieves' game. Those who stay in it long enough are invariably robbed." Chapter 18. New York City before Robert Moses. Now Robert Moses' eyes were turning again to the city around which, as a youth, he had wandered, burning up with ideas for its improvement. Nowhere had America's Great Depression struck harder than in America's greatest city. New York in 1932 was half-completed skyscrapers, work on them long since halted for the lack of funds, that glared down on the city from glassless windows. It was housewives scavenging for vegetables under pushcarts. It was crowds gathering at garbage dumps in Riverside Park and swarming onto them every time a new load was deposited, digging through the piles with sticks or hands in hopes of finding bits of food. New York was the soup kitchens operated from the back of army trucks in Times Square. It was the men, some of them wearing Chesterfield coats and Homburgs, who lined up at the soup kitchens with drooping shoulders and eyes that never looked up from the sidewalk. New York was the breadline, the worm that walks like a man. New York was the postman handing you the registered letter that you both knew was the eviction notice. It was the long queues that formed in the early afternoon at the municipal lodging houses, and it was the desperate haste of the men turned away to get to one of the nearby bars which allowed customers who purchased even a single drink to sleep on the floor as long as there was space. Subways were truly for sleeping, and when patrolmen walked along station platforms rapping on soles, the men lying there arose without a protest, carefully gathering up their pallets of newspapers, shuffled onto a train and rode to the next station, where they spread their papers and lay down again. More than 10,000 of New York's 29,000 manufacturing firms had closed their doors. Nearly one of every three employables in the city had lost his job. An estimated 1,600,000 New Yorkers were receiving some form of public relief. Many of those fortunates who had kept their jobs were underemployed, a euphemism for the fact that they worked 2 or 3 days a week or 2 weeks a month, or, if they worked full-time, were paid a fraction of their former salaries. Stenographers earning $35 to $40 per week in 1928 were averaging $16 in 1933. Woolworth's was paying full-time sales ladies $7 per week. Parents skimped for their children. By December 1932, many parents could hardly remember a time when they hadn't been skimping. But skimping was only forestalling the inevitable. There was meat on the table twice a week, and then once, and then not at all. Then there were no eggs. Parents could make their children feel it was an honor that they didn't have to drink milk anymore and could drink coffee instead, but the lack of proper diet took a toll. "Looking back, we can see quite a change," said one schoolteacher. "The children haven't any pep. They don't seem like the same youngsters they were a year ago. They seemed tired. They didn't seem to learn as fast," said a school nurse. "When you go into a classroom, you notice a different expression on their faces. There is a strained, anxious look, not natural in children at all." Sometimes the things that outsiders didn't see were worst of all. Teachers didn't see the children whose families were poorest. Such children had dropped out of school because they had no money for car fare, lunches, or suitable clothes. Staffers at the city's free health clinics were encouraged by the fact that the number of malnutrition cases they handled was rising only gradually, although by 1934 such cases nevertheless would account for 60% of all clinic work. Then the staffers realized that many people suffering from malnutrition simply weren't going to the clinics because they knew perfectly well what was wrong with them, and also knew that they would be unable to do anything about it. And no one could see a state of mind. All one could do was try best to describe it, as Martha Gellhorn did. "Everywhere there seemed a spreading listlessness, a whipped feeling. I find them all in the same shape. Fear, fear, an overpowering terror of the future." The city's government did little to help its people. The will to help was not the force that drove that government. That force was greed. During the 15 years in which Red Mike Hyland and then Beau James Walker had been chief magistrate of America's greatest city, the Tammany leaders who served under them had seemed motivated primarily by the desire to siphon the city's vast resources into a vast trough on which they could batten. Former Judge Samuel Seabury's investigation of corruption in the city, which had begun in 1930, had revealed how successfully this siphoning had been accomplished, exposing the bank accounts running into the hundreds of thousands of dollars of literally dozens of city officials who followed one another to the witness stand in a seemingly endless procession that was dubbed the Tin Box Parade, after one testified that he had found $360,000 in his home in a tin box, a wonderful tin box. Then Seabury turned to the magistrate's courts. Witnesses revealed that hundreds of innocent housewives and working girls had been framed as prostitutes and, if they could not raise the cash to buy their freedom, had been jailed, sometimes for months, by a cabal of crooked vice squad policemen, court clerks, and magistrates. Shocked by the strangling in Van Cortlandt Park of one scheduled female witness, her teenage daughter committed suicide a week later, the city listened in horror to the others Seabury paraded to the stand. One told of helping vice squad patrolmen trail a young married woman as she inspected houses with a male real estate agent. When they had returned to her home and were waiting for her husband to arrive and conclude the transaction, the police broke in, frightened the real estate agent out of testifying, and arrested her. Other witnesses testified that, when business was slow, the vice squad simply raided flats in Negro Harlem and made wholesale arrests at random. When Mayor Walker took the stand, "Don't look him straight in the eye," warned a Seabury aide familiar with Beau James' charm, and the former judge stood sideways to Walker as much as possible while questioning him, Seabury revealed that the mayor had personally accepted more than $1 million in beneficences from firms doing business with the city. On September 1, 1932, while Governor Roosevelt was pondering whether or not to remove Walker from office, the mayor resigned and sailed for Europe to join Betty Monk Compton, last and loveliest of his paramours, thereby following a traveling precedent established by Robert C. Van Wyck, the first mayor, 1898-1901, of the Consolidated City, who had died in Paris, and the man who had handpicked Van Wyck for the job, Tammany boss Richard Croker, who had died in England. Surrogate John Patrick O'Brien won the special election to fill the remaining year of Walker's term, but he proved to be as much a creature of Tammany as his predecessors. While Tammany leaders were trying to persuade the electorate that they had no control over him, O'Brien was replying to reporters who asked him who his police commissioner would be. "I don't know. They haven't told me yet." And during O'Brien's administration, local Tammany relief administrators would siphon off a big chunk of federal relief payments before they reached their intended recipients, and the city would continue to do nothing to supplement federal programs, although a supplement would have been helpful since federal payments averaged $17 per week per family. Tammany would try to use federal payments to build its political power, putting ward healers on relief payrolls under several different names so that they could draw several salaries for themselves. And the federal payrolls did not show whether the men receiving its money were the men who most needed it. In New York City under Tammany Hall, the test for employment on a federal project was generally politics rather than need. Most applicants had to be cleared by their local Tammany leader. One leader boasted, "This is how we make Democrats." Even had the city wanted to help its people, it would have been unable to. The Depression had forced New York to total up at last the cost of its rake's progress under the Hyland and Walker administrations. When Hyland became mayor of New York on January 1, 1918, the city's population was 5,872,143. 15 years later, when Walker resigned, it was 6,930,446, an increase of 15%. During that same period, the city's budget rose from $240,519,858 to $631,366,298, an increase of 250%. The per capita cost of the budget increased by 200%. Year in and year out, between January 1, 1918 and December 31, 1932, the city's debt increased at a rate equal to $100,000 per day, until, on the latter date, it had reached the staggering total of $1,897,481,478. A figure that was almost equal to the combined debt of the 48 states, and that required an annual appropriation for debt service, the payment of interest and amortization, of $209,960,338, almost a third of the entire budget. Since jobs were the fuel of Tammany's political machine, a disproportionate share of the rest of the budget went to purchase that fuel. Between the day Hyland entered office and the day Walker left it, the number of city employees almost doubled, and their salaries, paid as political rewards at levels far above those paid for similar work in private industry, almost tripled. In 1932, they totaled $311,937,199. City officials acted as if they believed that the budgetary gyre could go on widening indefinitely. They based their optimism on the fact that the value of taxable real estate in the city, the base of the city's tax structure, was increasing almost as fast as city expenditures. As a result, even while the city's budget soared, there was only a slight increase in the real estate tax rate. If the Hyland and Walker administrations had erected a huge superstructure of city expenditures, that superstructure was nonetheless resting on a base that they thought was steadily broadening. Even before the Depression, however, the rate of increase in the base had begun to slow down ominously. The annual percentage of increase in the value of taxable real estate in the city was 12 in 1927, but only 9 in 1928, and 8 in 1929. The Depression forced this key percentage down to 6 in 1930, 3 in 1931, 1 in 1932. And the Depression forced up another key percentage, the percentage of real estate taxes which the city was unable to collect. In the years between 1928 and 1932, this percentage was, successively, 11, 13, 15, 18, 26. The uncollected balance of the 1932 real estate tax, the tax which had to finance the bulk of the city's debt service and current expenditures, was $137,613,213. The base on which the top-heavy superstructure of city finances teetered was shrinking, and it was shrinking fast. The superstructure began to topple. In desperation, the city deferred its required annual payments to the teachers' retirement fund and expropriated sinking fund surpluses already obligated for small-scale public improvements. Unable, despite these expedients, to meet even its ordinary day-to-day expenses, it was forced to borrow to pay them, at interest rates set higher and higher by bankers increasingly leery of the city's ability to repay. By 1931, even Jimmy Walker was talking about economizing. But the city's economizing capacity was limited because one-third of its budget was allocated for an all-but-irreducible debt service and because of political realities. The city payroll had become the payroll of the Tammany political machine, and while a city might reduce the number of its employees or their salaries, it was less easy for a political machine to throw its retainers off the payroll or substantially reduce their stipends. City construction contracts had become the main ingredient of the rich swill of graft to which the palate of Tammany leaders, including those party leaders who held high city office, had become accustomed. City officials could reduce a city's appropriations for construction, but men accustomed to feeding at a well-filled trough were far less ready to reduce their own portions. Even while talking economy, city officials made clear that they would not economize on construction appropriations or salaries. There was one exception. One group of city employees, school teachers, were not part of the Tammany machine. In 1930 and 1931, the city fired 11,000 school teachers. The 1932 city budget was the highest ever. The city proposed to finance it with a record increase in the real estate tax. But the day of reckoning for 15 years of Tammany rule was at hand, when, in January 1932, the city attempted to float new loans to meet the payroll coming due at the end of the month. Bankers, convinced that the loans could not be repaid if the city spent money during the coming year at the rate it proposed, refused to make them unless the budget was reduced. The city complied by virtually halting all repairs to its physical plant. It refinanced $250 million of subway bonds, which the city had planned to redeem out of current revenues, by selling long-term bonds in their stead, an expedient which loaded future generations of city taxpayers with a monstrous rapid transit debt. Still, the city's balance sheet reddened. By December 1932, it was forced to go hat in hand to the bankers again, and when new loans were made contingent on further budget reductions, it had no choice but to cut the salaries of city employees by 6 to 33%. And hundreds of millions of dollars in short-term revenue notes would be coming due in 1933, and there was no money in sight to pay them. Although Walker and O'Brien attempted to do so, it was a misleading oversimplification to blame the Depression for all of New York's problems. The truth was that the city had been falling further and further behind in the race to meet the needs of its people in good times as well as bad, and under reform as well as Tammany administrations. The city's failure was most apparent, and the problems largest, in those categories of municipal responsibility in which the betterment of its people's lives required the construction of public works on a scale commensurate with the city's size. The concern of the people's tribunes during the Lowe and Mitchell reform administrations had been for the people's welfare, but that welfare had been conceived of primarily as a lessening of the burden on taxpayers through governmental economy rather than through the construction of civic improvements whose cost would increase that burden. And while Tammany administrations had spent the taxpayers' money with a lavish hand, the taxpayers had received in return surprisingly little increment in life-improving steel and concrete, because the disproportionate amount of the city's budget funneled by Tammany into salaries, into patronage, left little money available for construction contract appropriations. The quality of men added to the city payroll, moreover, did not match the quantity, thanks to Hyland's destruction of civil service safeguards. If there was a man less devoted to the merit system than Red Mike, it was his successor. When Bo James departed for Europe, he left behind him, on the rosters of the engineering staffs of the borough presidents, the staffs which alone, under the existing city charter, were empowered to draw the plans for major public improvements, a group of engineers, of whom a substantial percentage lacked a high school diploma. And the city's resultant lack of technical expertise crippled its ability to carry out, or even conceive, complicated public works. So did the amount of graft, the grease which kept the Tammany machine moving smoothly. From condemnation awards, every time the city built a school, a politician went into the real estate business, LaGuardia growled, to certificates of completion, every step toward a public improvement required a payoff. Since contractors had to include the cost of such payoffs in their estimates of the cost of city construction work, their bids had to be inflated accordingly. The amount of steel and concrete that a city dollar purchased was correspondingly reduced, and the size of contracts the city awarded was not matched by improvements to the civic estate. The city did not get what it paid for, commented Fusion financial expert Joseph D. McGoldrick, although it certainly paid for what it got, several times over. For its single major public improvement, the construction of the independent subway system, the Walker administration paid $800 million, approximately twice what outside experts said the job should have cost. And when the $800 million had been spent, substantial portions of the subway were still uncompleted. And since the hands which city inspectors held out, palms up, to contractors could not easily be doubled into hard fists of regulation, the quality of public works in New York City was more than slightly suspect. No fewer than 40 public schools constructed during Walker's administration had to be closed for major repairs, for ceilings that fell, roofs that leaked, stairways that collapsed, and plumbing that didn't work at all, within a year of opening. The gap between the city's physical plant and the increasing needs of its expanding population had, then, been widening in virtually all areas of municipal responsibility. The total accomplishment of the Walker administration in public housing, for example, consisted of the rehabilitation of some of the tenements on one block, and the number of public hospital beds when Bo James left office was precisely the same as when he entered it. But because of the sudden burgeoning in the use of the automobile and in the desire for active recreation, the city's failure to produce for its people was especially galling in precisely those areas in which Robert Moses had already produced, just outside New York City, so much: highways, bridges, and parks. New York was strangling on its traffic. In 1918, when Hyland took office, there were 125,101 motor vehicles in the city. In 1932, there were 790,173. In all those 15 years, not a single usable mile of arterial highway had been constructed within the city's borders. Motorists were forced to travel through or around New York in 1932 on the same local streets that had existed in 1918, streets complete with intersecting traffic, traffic lights, and traffic jams reporters had long since run out of adjectives attempting to describe. In 1913, Robert Moses had stood on a high bluff overlooking the muddy wasteland that was Riverside Park and had envisioned a great parkway running through it. In 1932, there was still no highway. The city had begun construction in 1927 of a West Side elevated highway running along the waterfront from the Battery as far uptown as 72nd Street, the park's southern border. But the pace of construction had been so slow that, when the Depression brought it to a halt in 1931, substantial portions of the highway had not been built. Not that that mattered much, since neither had the entrance and exit ramps that would make it usable. And since there were no plans to extend the highway through Riverside Park, motorists heading for Westchester and New England still had to make their way through, and add to, the congenital traffic jams of Manhattan and the Bronx before they could reach the broad Sawmill River Parkway, which Moses had built down to the city line. Queens had once been the only borough with adequate through roads. Manhattan families heading for Nassau and Suffolk counties, once past the East River bridges, had not encountered serious delays until they reached the city line and the narrow roads beyond. But with the construction beyond the line of Moses Parks and Parkways, the situation was now reversed. The lure of his creations had steadily increased the traffic flow through Queens, and its boulevards were inadequate to handle it. Furthermore, none of the boulevards linked up with a parkway, so drivers wanting to use one had to endure local streets before they got to it. As for Brooklyn, borough of churches, its inhabitants had been praying for a way out of it for decades. There was, in the entire borough, not a single major through thoroughfare. There was no way out of its vast center, no way to reach Manhattan or Queens or Nassau County, except via local streets. And the streets of Brooklyn, like those of Queens, were becoming more clogged every year. The population of the two boroughs increased by more than 1 million between 1920 and 1930. As for connections for automobiles under or over the water which separated the city's boroughs, there hadn't been one built in a quarter of a century. Two connections had been built, by the Port of New York Authority between the city and New Jersey, the Holland Tunnel, which opened in 1927, and the George Washington Bridge, which opened in 1931. Manhattan motorists bound for the Bronx, Westchester, or New England, after crawling uptown through Manhattan's congestion, found when they reached Manhattan's northern boundary, the Harlem River, that the only way to cross it to get to the congested streets of the Bronx was the Broadway drawbridge, only 3 lanes wide and so crammed with pillars that traffic tie-ups at either end often extended for blocks. On an average day in 1932, the bridge was raised 14 times to permit the passage of ships. When one of these raisings occurred at rush hour, the tie-up could extend for miles. Northbound motorists could, of course, cross the Harlem River on one of 7 bridges that had been built years before. The newest was finished in 1910, miles to the south. But these bridges debouched into the most congested section of the Bronx, miles from the parkways and other broad roads of Westchester. The population of Long Island, concentrated in Brooklyn and Queens, was more than 4 million in 1932, greater than all except 8 states. But except for a few small and ancient ferries that plied the East River, the only way on or off Long Island for motorists was the same quartet of East River bridges that had existed in 1909. Long Island still didn't possess a single vehicular link with the mainland United States. The island didn't possess a single vehicular link with Manhattan Island north of 59th Street, where the Queensborough Bridge touched down. The Queensborough, in fact, was the only link with Manhattan north of Corlears Hook, where the Brooklyn, Manhattan, and Williamsburg spans debouched traffic into the already jammed thoroughfares of the Lower East Side. On an average weekday in 1933, 238,277 trucks and cars, 3 times what they were built to handle, poured onto the East River bridges. The Queensborough carried more cars than any other span in the country. The inadequacy of the approaches to these bridges was matched by the inadequacy of their roadways. Built for horses, not automobiles, they were too narrow for cars and so slippery that, according to a police report, on the Brooklyn Bridge alone, 12 accidents were not uncommon on a rainy day. City officials had been talking for years about repaving the bridges, but no repaving had been done. They had been talking for years about widening their roadways, but no widening had been done. Although in 1932 the Queensborough Bridge had been open for a quarter of a century, the city had not yet gotten around even to marking lanes on it. At either end of the bridge were traffic lights. When they were red, bridge traffic stopped completely. A 1931 police study found that during rush hours, the average driver, frantically shifting gears while trying to keep his car in an unmarked lane, spent 43 minutes negotiating the 1,182 feet of the Queensborough span. The city had created two additional lanes on the Queensborough Upper Roadway in 1931, but when the lanes were opened, it was discovered that there had been a slight miscalculation. The lanes were too narrow. Cars were constantly